to consider the amendment of Section 25 of the Constitution to allow expropriation of land without compensation. From the outset, we have said that we want to hear all the voices, all the political parties, however small they may be, and all other stakeholders, because this is a matter that affects the people of South Africa as a whole, and we want to make sure that the outcome is a legitimate outcome that is also consistent with our multi-party democracy. But also, South Africa is not an island. We live, we are part of the global village. We are part of treaties, there are international laws. We also want to make sure that whatever we do is consistent with our international obligations. It is for that reason that we invited the Department of Trade and Industry to brief us on what our international obligations are, so that when we deliberate on the bill, all members of parliament bear in mind what those international obligations are. And we are pleased that the department has sent Ambassador Karim to come and brief us. I think there couldn't be a better choice than an ambassador, because he will not theorize about the international law. He has been part of operating in that space. Ambassador, you are most welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair, honorable members. Good afternoon, and thank you very much for the opportunity to make this input into your discussions, very important discussions in this committee. We had received a request from the committee secretary for the DTI, as you've indicated, to make an input on South Africa's international obligations in respect of the expropriation of land and the obligation to pay compensation when land is expropriated. And we were also asked to answer the question, what has been done to align our international obligations with the developmental obligations contained in the Constitution? So the input that we will make is an attempt to try to respond to those two requests. We have prepared a written brief, which I believe has been circulated to members. And it's structured in a way to try to answer the questions as best we can. I would underline the fact that this is not a legal opinion. What we had prepared is an input based on the DTI's experience with respect to bilateral investment treaties to which South Africa is a party. In 2008 to 2010, we undertook a very extensive review of our bilateral investment treaties, which led to an attempt to reform our approach, including to terminate investment treaties. And since then, South Africa and particularly the Department of Trade and Industry, the division that deals with these matters, has been engaged in an ongoing international debate on investment treaties, and so we thought we would want to share that experience with the committee. So we think that what we would indicate today is perhaps some policy considerations that the committee would be interested as you'd indicated, Chair, we understand that the ad hoc committee is considering the question of Section 25 of the SA Constitution on expropriation and compensation in general, and in particular situations where the compensation for expropriation of land can be nil or without compensation. Now, let me start by indicating that the questions of expropriation and compensation are taken up in bilateral investment treaties in general. South African government in the early 90s, from 94 onwards to about 2000, signed something like in the region of 49 investment treaties, bilateral investment treaties. But of those, only 22 came into force. They were properly ratified, they were tabled in Parliament under the relevant requirements. The bids contain legal undertakings on expropriation and compensation that cover property of any foreign investor from a home country that has a bilateral investment treaty with South Africa. So it would cover, for instance, we had a bilateral investment treaty with the UK. So UK citizens that have invested in South Africa, the treaty would cover those, and the 22 other countries would be covered in that way, citizens of those countries. Bilateral investment treaties don't make specific reference to land per se, but they extend protection to investments that is defined in very open-ended terms, which follow what is referred to as an asset-based approach. So the protection covers every kind of asset of an investor in the territory of the host country where there is some economic benefit associated with the investment. Bilateral investment treaties recognize the right of host countries, in this case South Africa, to expropriate foreign property, but that expropriation is subject to certain requirements. In general, lawful expropriation of foreign investment has to be taken for a public purpose, on a non-discriminatory basis, under due process of law, and very importantly, for the purposes of this dialogue, must be based on the payment of prompt, adequate, and effective compensation. Those are the terms in the investment treaties. Now, on compensation in particular, there's some variation in the way the language is captured in the different bilateral investment treaties. For instance, the South African Italian bilateral investment treaty calls for immediate, full, and effective compensation. In others, it states that it must be market value. It's quite specific. But in general, arbitration, international arbitration on this matter has concluded that in the absence of very clear indications in the legal text to the contrary, compensation is always due for lawful expropriation, and compensation is taken to mean fair market value. That is the international jurisprudence on that. So those are the first set of issues we wanted to share with the committee. The second is the question of the relationship between bilateral investment treaties and the Constitution. We know very clearly that in South Africa the Constitution is the supreme law of the land to which all law and conduct must apply in South Africa. From an international law perspective, bilateral investment treaties constitute an international treaty, and the constitution of any country is seen as part of internal law. According to the Vienna Convention on Treaties, a government cannot invoke its internal law, including its constitution, as a justification for not meeting the treaty obligations. So again, this is another, I think, important consideration for the committee, the relationship between the law, the constitution, our laws, and in respect of bilateral investment treaties. That, I think, is essentially where we are with these treaties. But I thought it would be important to also give a little bit of background how these treaties came into force and how we've tried to address what we see as shortcomings in the treaties. And I'll try to outline this very quickly, Chair. The first bilateral investment treaty was signed in 1959 between Germany and Pakistan. For something like 30 years, there were very few of these investment treaties signed. There were a handful, not more than 30 or 40 over the next 30 years or so. In the 1990s, we started to see an increase in the number of investment treaties being signed between different countries. So there was an increase overall in the number of bilateral treaties signed between countries. And South Africa emerges from its apartheid past during this period, 1994. And in that period, from 1994 onwards, we signed something like 10 to 12 agreements very quickly, mainly with European countries. The first treaty was signed with the UK, bilateral investment treaty was signed with the UK in 1994, and that model became the one that was used for others subsequently. The rationale at the time, I was a junior official in the department at the time, so I have a vague memory of how this had emerged, but essentially the rationale that was given to signing these treaties was that they would provide confidence to foreign investors in the South African economy in the immediate post-apartheid period, because democratic South Africa's economic policy was not well known. That by signing these, you would give confidence to foreign investors to invest in South Africa. That was the one set of arguments. The other set of arguments was that these investment treaties were not very problematic. We shouldn't worry about them. Many countries are signing them, and that we should see it as part of South Africa's re-entry into the international community, normalizing our international relations after the isolation of apartheid, and that this would help us to strengthen bilateral investment treaties. Now, I have to say, when we've reviewed all of this, I think it would be fair to say that not just in South Africa, but globally, there was not a very good understanding of what the implications of bilateral investment treaties were at that time. There were very few legal challenges. Countries did not understand what the implications of investment treaties were, and that would have been in the early to late 1990s. I think it's also important to note that many of these treaties were signed before the South African Constitution came into effect in 1996. At least five or six were signed before the new constitution. But the complacency and the kind of relaxed attitude towards investment treaties began to change in the late 90s, and particularly after 2000s onwards. And that had to do with the very rapid increase in the number of legal challenges that countries were facing as investors started to understand what these treaties meant, and that they could be used to challenge government policy, government regulation. And particularly in the end of 90s financial crisis, the number of international legal challenges increased very dramatically. In about 2002, South Africa faced its first challenge under a bilateral investment treaty. It was by a Swiss investor investing in South Africa that believed that his property had not received adequate police protection, challenged the government for not providing the kind of protection that is set out in the treaty, and was successful. The amount at that time, if I'm not mistaken, that was had to be paid to him was about 5 million euros at that time. That was the first South African experience with investment treaties. Later, soon after that, but going right up until about 2007, we were involved in a case where a number of Italian citizens in South Africa challenged the 2004 Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act, MPRDA. That had been, I think everyone will recall, it was part of our effort to increase the participation of historically disadvantaged South Africans in the mining industry. And they charged that that policy was in fact expropriation of mineral rights. That case went on for about 2 or 3 years. In the end, there was not a final resolution to the case. There were some adjustments that were made domestically, and the claimants, the Italian investors, withdrew the case. But what that showed to us at the time is how exposed we would be to policies, legislation that goes through a democratic process in South Africa, that comes to Parliament, that is adopted in Parliament, that goes to, as signed off by the President, could be overturned by an international arbitration via the bilateral investment treaties. And so that made us sit up and take notice. And so in 2008, we did a few things. The first was that there were a number of negotiations going on with countries for new bilateral investment treaties. What we did first is to say, pause. We don't negotiate anymore until we have a review. And that review went on from 2008 to 2010. All of this is in the briefing note that we had. That review was an intensive discussion intergovernmentally with different departments, with business and labor in NEDLAC. We brought in academics in South Africa, think tanks in South Africa, but also international expertise into this. Over 2 or 3 years, we had a very intense discussion about investment treaties. And what we've tried to do in the briefing is to outline what the review showed us. That was our first intensive review of investment treaties and to understand what the implications were. What we discovered and what we looked at, and I think these are where the policy considerations come in, is that the bilateral investment treaties are in many ways very unbalanced in the way that they're constructed. It allows investors to challenge government policy, but it doesn't allow governments to challenge investors for behavior that they may undertake. It is discriminatory in the sense that it only allows foreign investors to revert to international arbitration, and so discriminates against South African investors, domestic investors. I mean, it's not just South Africa, this is investment in general. So there's a discrimination factor from that perspective. When we subjected the provisions in the agreement to scrutiny, we realized that the provisions in the agreement, the standard provisions in the agreement, and there are a number of these, including how you define investment, how you define investor, what you mean by expropriation, direct expropriation, indirect expropriation, fair and equitable treatment, and as well as compensation, the provisions are not very precise. There are a lot of variations in it. There's a lot of ambiguity in it. And what that means is that when these go for international arbitration, the lack of consistency is amplified, that you have very many outcomes that are quite inconsistent one from the other, and it's very unpredictable. I'd mentioned earlier that one of the main arguments for investment treaties was that the view was that if you sign these treaties, you would get new flows of foreign investment. The empirical evidence doesn't correspond to that. We have, and this is an international assessment, that this is clearly bilateral investment treaties are not decisive in encouraging investment or deterring investment. We have flows of investment from countries that we don't have an investment treaty with, and some countries that we have investment treaties, we get very little investment. So there's no direct correlation between increases in FDI flows as a result of bilateral investment treaties. Over time, what we've seen is that the number of claims that are being brought against governments globally, internationally, is growing very rapidly. I mentioned there was there were only 50 by challenges by 2000. That had gone up by 10 times up until 2012, so up to 514 by 2012. And by this year, the beginning of this year, it was almost double that. It was 942. So the number of claims that are being brought by investors against government policies around the world has increased dramatically. If you do just a very brief analysis, you'll see that most of the challenges are against developing country governments, and you'd see most of the awards are in favor of the investment, of the investors. And you would also see that the amounts of compensation being claimed is increasing significantly. So you have we have problems with the treaties themselves, the fact that they're quite ambiguous. You have increasing claims, but then there's also another important element, and this is something that we've become increasingly aware of after the review in the last few years, and that has to do with deficiencies in the international investment arbitration system. First of all, the system itself has very many different venues. You can choose different venues to have an arbitration. They have different histories, they have different cultures, they have different procedures. There are recurring episodes of inconsistent awards and decisions taken by arbitrators on dealing with the same matter, depending on which arbitrators are there in different outcomes. So there's a lack of consistency and clarity in the international arbitration system. And then there's the fundamental question, which I alluded to earlier, is whether the arbitration process itself, conducted by three individuals, whether or not that possesses sufficient legitimacy to assess acts of state on sensitive public policy matters. The lack of consistency in the way that arbitrators deal with this has led to views that the system lacks an institutional framework for judicial accountability or for the independence of arbitrators. Sometimes arbitrators arbitrate, sometimes they are defending the claimant, sometimes they are defending the government. So it's not a very consistent, clear process. In particular, what we found that is perhaps most relevant or immediate relevant is that some of the bilateral investment treaty provisions are inconsistent with South Africa's constitution. And here the inconsistency is most pronounced in the South African constitutional requirement that compensation is just and equitable, whereas in the bilateral investment treaties they are the references towards market value. Now, the concerns that we have raised that I've mentioned here today that came out of the South African review is not confined just to South Africa. If you were to read many, many jurisdictions around the world, similar concerns are being raised. This is a concern across many jurisdictions, and there are many attempts at reforming the system. So the system itself is under a process of reform. When we took the recommendations, the highlighting the outcomes of the review to Cabinet in 2010, Cabinet considered this carefully and made a decision to review our approach to investment policy making, and there were essentially five elements to that decision in 2010. In July 2010, the Cabinet proposed five main elements in its decision. The first was that we should develop a new investment act in South Africa. The second, that we would only enter into bilateral investment treaties in future where there is compelling economic or political reasons to do so and where there's clear benefit to South Africa as a result of those investment treaties. Third, that the development we would need to develop a new bilateral investment template that would shape any negotiation for future, and that it has to be in line with South African constitution, and policy. Fourth is that we should terminate existing bilateral investment treaties. And the fifth was that we establish an interministerial committee of ministers with the relevant departments that would oversee all of this work. Now, let me just say a few things about termination. We had to move very quickly. The way the bilateral investment treaties are formulated is that once you sign them, there's an initial period where they have where they are valid, and usually it's 10 years. If you want to terminate an agreement, you have to. If you don't do anything, the treaty is automatically renewed for another 10 years. If you want to terminate a year before that first 10 years is up, you have to notify your partner and say, in 1 year's time, when this treaty comes up, we are proposing to terminate. Now, because we had started with the European countries, most of their treaties were coming due very quickly, and we had to give them a year's notice to terminate. So we had to move very quickly with the European partners. And of course, if you moved with one but not the other, that would be also a problem. So we had to move consistently. Also, because this is in 2010, the Lisbon Treaty that the EU had concluded was taking away the power of negotiating bilateral investment treaties from member states and vesting it with the European Commission. So it was being consolidated in the EU with the European Commission. So we were not going to be able to negotiate with to deal with individual countries. We had to terminate with all of them. So that was the motivation to move most quickly with European bilateral investment treaties. They were the most imminent. Most of the treaties are with European countries. We have two in Latin America, with Cuba and Argentina, two in Asia, China and Korea, and we have four in Africa, Nigeria, Senegal, Mauritius and Zimbabwe. So we have moved to terminate, and I'll come to how we're dealing with those in a minute. One of the other very serious issues is in these investment treaties, they have what is referred to as a survival clause. And the survival clause means that even if you terminate the agreement, there's a period of time that the investment that was covered, that entered into your country during the period that it was in force, existing investment, would be protected for another period of time. And depending on the agreement, you'll see it's protected for 10 years, some of them say 15 years, and there are a handful that say 20 years. So it's a survival clause, it could be called a sunset clause, it continues the protection for a period of time. So we have formally terminated 12 agreements. It includes the European countries, it includes Argentina. The four agreements with African countries, we had taken the view that those would be dealt with in the context of an investment protection, an Africa-wide investment protection agreement that is to be negotiated under the African free trade, continental free trade area. So we won't terminate these, but they would be taken over by an Africa-wide investment agreement. The bilateral investment treaties with China and Russia are still under discussion. The initial periods came much later, so there's more time for discussion with them. There are two agreements that require a slightly different approach. And this has to do with another inconsistency it has to do with the consistency in the way that the agreements were had entered into force. Either agreements need to enter into force, they need to be tabled in Parliament, and this is set out in Section 231 on international agreements, that either the agreement is tabled under Section 231, Paragraph 2, where it states that an international agreement binds the Republic only after it has been approved by resolution in both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. And so that is the normal, that's the normal full ratification. There's a second option, which is Paragraph 3, where it indicates that agreements that are of a technical, administrative, or executive nature, or an agreement which does not require either ratification or accession entered into by the National Executive, binds the Republic without the approval of the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, but must be tabled in the Assembly and the Council within a period of time. So for some, for a few of the agreements, they were tabled under under Paragraph 3, others under Paragraph 2. And so the agreements with Cuba and South Korea, we've been advised by a legal opinion saying that in order to terminate those, we need to go back to Parliament to make the request. And so that is the delay there. But that's how we've tried to deal with the termination. That is the state of the termination, and then some explanation on the survival clause. Let me just conclude, Chair, by saying that the Department had followed through as it could with the mandate from Cabinet. We have made significant progress on terminating existing bilateral investment treaties. In 2015, we had prepared a new act, and that has been adopted by Parliament and has entered into force. We have a new model bilateral investment treaty, but we did that as part of SADC. So it's a SADC model, a set of guidelines which tries to address the concerns that we had. So we have made progress on that. And perhaps just to make it clear that for the time being, the bits remain in force. For those that have been terminated, the survival clause of those remain in force for a period of time. And so if land of a foreign investor was expropriated, and that investor is from a country that has a bilateral investment treaty with South Africa, including if the survival clause is in effect, effect. That investor, the affected investor, foreign investor, could invoke a legal challenge under the bilateral investment treaty against the government if the investor is not satisfied by the amount of the compensation. If they invoke the treaty, it would go to an international arbitration, and the arbitrators would make a decision on that. It's not, we can't prejudge what the arbitrators would decide, but the experience suggests that they would take into account national law and the constitution, but the primary reference is the agreement, the bilateral investment treaty. And on compensation, as I'd indicated, the standard in the international jurisprudence has tended to be on market value of the investment immediately before the expropriation took place. There is one other point I thought is important to raise, is that we have preferential access to the United States market under the general system of trade preferences provides South Africa with preferences. This is not an obligation on us, but there are criteria that are associated with getting that access, and the relevant criteria says, and I'll read it out, a beneficiary, which would be in this case South Africa, may not have nationalized, expropriated, or otherwise seized the property of U.S. citizens or corporations without providing or taking steps to provide prompt, adequate, and effective compensation, or submitting such issues to a mutually agreed forum for arbitration. So I think that's also important to take note of. Access to the U.S. market under the GSP is in part conditional on us meeting that eligibility requirement. And perhaps, Chair, I will stop there and try to answer any questions that may arise.
It's very difficult. I thought that South Africa is a special case. Maybe you should address us on the fact that we are dealing with a country that was a pariah, a country which was pursuing policies which were regarded as crimes against humanity, and that there were sanctions against the country. Now, does the fact that there were sanctions against the country, what would be the effect of countries that entered into agreements which an apartheid government, contrary to international law, what effect would that have on the validity of such agreements, and also the question of the legal uncertainty, and then you have a sunset clause amid uncertainty. How this survival clause then be binding on a country, a developing country, that seeks to address its own in internal needs. What basically, what would you advise us to do? Because the law, international law, is uncertain, and there's a survival clause, and you are in the process of reviewing, and we don't know how long the review is going to take. And our situation is that at the end of March, we want to finalize an amendment to the Constitution. And that is an entrenched provision of the Constitution, which cannot wait for the review and all these processes. So what would be your advice to us?
It's a very difficult question to answer. I understand completely as the way that you've responded, you've set out the background, South Africa being a pariah, the sanctions, the fact apartheid was recognized as a crime against humanity, etc., and we're trying to correct these imbalances, this legacy of apartheid. I completely understand that. The issue is that the bilateral investment treaties were signed post-1994, after signed by the new government in 1994 and onwards. And as I tried to indicate, at the time there was not a recognition that these would be that these could be problematic. There was very little experience in this regard. Subsequently, what we've come to understand is that these agreements have force, they have teeth. Investors can use them to challenge the policy of different countries, and it's across the world. Argentina has hundreds of cases against it, for instance. South Africa has just had two, as I mentioned. So the cases are coming against governments around the world, and the question of how an arbitrator or how arbitration would review, would view an expropriation of a foreign investor that has a bilateral investment treaty, South Africa, if they were to use this, if they were to use the investment treaty to challenge the government measure, if their property was expropriated, is for those that have arbitration very difficult to know what they would, the arbitrators would decide. What we know from the experience is that the primary reference document for arbitrators on international investment treaties, for on investment treaties, has been, as I indicated, the standard has been market value. Governments have been, in general, required to pay. That is the reality of, that is the experience under these agreements. The criticisms that I was pointing out to earlier, the imbalances, the lack of clarity and all of that, were reasons for trying to, led to the decision by Cabinet in 2010 to terminate. The fact is that these agreements have the survival clause, so they still have some teeth. And that's the really the difficulty that we have to navigate.
Honourable members, I guess we have been empowered, and I would like to open the floor, because after this we have to go and make serious decisions, and our mandate is that there's no going back, so we must put all the relevant questions so that when we decide, we don't say overlook anything. But another thing which I just wanted to raise is, you know, if you have to settle something, it depends on your ability, and it could be said you'll do it progressively, and once you are not allowed to do it progressively, it means that you are asked to do the impossible, whether international law imposes obligations which are impossible to discharge. And has that been addressed anywhere else or what?
I only tell you that
can't I be allowed to settle that progressively, because of the limitation of my resources, why do, am I expected to buy immediately?
Chairperson, I think you are honestly creating a dialogue between you and the president. I thought that as a presiding officer of this meeting, you allow the presenter to present, you ask the members to ask questions, and then you come and make an intervention later. It can't be that the presenter presents and already you're having a dialogue with him, because you could have just had the private discussion elsewhere without us here. So can we please allow the members of parliament to interact with the presenter, and you can still have the opportunity to try to synchronize what the members are saying, and then you make your own observations, and if there's clarity questions that you want to ask as well, you ask within that context. But you can't be the first one to want to have a dialogue with the presenter before members of parliament engage with that perspective. I, every other meeting that I attend in parliament, that is the modus operandi. And I'm requesting that we use that in that format.
With respect, I wanted to make sure that the presenter has finalized the presentation. And that's why I put this question. So that when I open for discussion, then the presenter is not going to continue the presentation, but engage with the discussion. I proceed.
Chair, I'm not sure I can answer your question directly. In a very clear way. What I am trying to indicate is that we have agreements that are written, that are in force, that South Africa has signed. Even though we've terminated most of them, there is the survival clause, and so we need to understand that. If there is a challenge under this, and it was to go to an arbitration, and the arbitration would make a determination that this is the amount that is due for compensation. Perhaps it's in that context that, what if I understood you, that it's not something that could be done right away, it's something that could be done over time. But in terms of the agreements that are in force now, this is the terrible message I'm bringing to this committee, is that there are these agreements that are in force now that have certain, create certain obligations and certain rights. The obligations are on government, the rights are for investors. I think I tried to make that point in the presentation. That is the problem. That is the problem, and that's what we have to take into account.
Thank you very much for a very informed and detailed presentation. Honourable members, Honourable Rosetta, Honourable Shibambo, Honourable Owen,
I'm on the floor. Thank you, Chairperson. I think let's appreciate the correctly say information is power. But whatever information comes your way cannot just be used raw and fresh as it is presented without being interpreted. I think we must, while appreciating the information that we get, the meeting must be understood within the following context, which I'm going to indicate here. Of course, others may add whatever they are going to add. That South Africa is true, it's a sovereign state. The sovereignty of South Africa as a republic or as a country cannot be challenged, it's a fact. Number two, we admit, Chairperson, that we don't live as South Africans or operate in isolation. We have got interactions with other countries, hence we are talking here about the BTIs as presented. Number three, this document, it's one can say, well, to some of us it's like a bombshell. You see, it could have been better maybe if it was forwarded in advance. We go through it so that when the presentation comes, we have our minds illuminated and ready to receive. Some of these things and the information come here comes as a shock, and it would have needed other people to interact with the document even before we come in a meeting of this nature. And number four, we are operating as a committee based on the mandate that comes from our parliament. We are not a pseudo state per se. We exist and exist within the law. And hence I indicated when I started about the sovereignty of the state. One can indicate, like I've already alluded to it, that it is like a bombshell thrown, or it's a hard pill, the manner in which the information comes. It appears, apart from the 2013 termination of bills as per this document, the country is actually run from outside. I'm not surprised by some of the questions, Chairperson, you raised. I thought I'm the only one shocked, but I could hear from the questions that you raised that you are equally in the same stable, shocked of shock. It appears that the country still remains run from somewhere. But however, my question, which will be simple, I may come back with some follow-up questions. And I want to believe that at the end of the day, whatever we are going to interact with the presentation will assist us when we are going to sit on our own to come up with what it is expected of us as per the mandate of Parliament. But the question I want to ask, I'm not a legal person per se. You will have to bear with my ignorance somewhere. But that I'm not a chicken, I can't lay eggs, it doesn't mean I may not be able to identify between the rotten egg and the well egg. What is it between the Constitution and the BTIs? Which one is running supreme? This is the first question I want to say. We are talking about a sovereign state here which has got its own constitution recognized by international world. Between the Constitution and the BTIs, as stated, which one runs supreme? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Murat Setla, Honorable Shivambo.
Thanks, Che. There's no crisis at all here. If we had given ourselves time to read Chapter 14 of the Constitution of South Africa, we realize that we don't have a crisis at all, because Section 1 of the Constitution 1 establishes South Africa as a sovereign democratic state, which is based on constitutional supremacy and the supremacy of the rule of law. And in Chapter 14, that deals with the general matters. In Section 232, says customary international law is law in the Republic unless it is inconsistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. There's no crisis there. So every year the law that is an international law that comes must be consistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. And an earlier section on international agreements, in section 231, section 2314 says that any international agreement becomes law in a republic when it is enacted into law by national legislation, but a self-executing provision of an agreement that has been approved by Parliament is law in the Republic, unless it is inconsistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. In 2015, we passed the Investment Act, which again was an attempt to unite all these investment treaties which the Slovene government has entered into. They're not a lot, because those are in fact now are 22. And where it said that there must be common law, and part of what that law says, which we passed in 2015 in the National Assembly, is that all investments that must be established in South Africa must be established in compliance of the laws of the Republic. And we are the legislating body. We are the body that is mandated by the Constitution to either amend the Constitution or enact legislation. So we can do anything in that context. And whatever investment comes thereafter will have to appreciate the dynamics that I had played there. I would have thought, Chair, that because you call the trading industry, you should have requested that you properly locate the form and content of investments that come from foreign nations into South Africa. Where do they happen? What value are they? What security of tenure do they have in certain instances? I'll for instance give an example that more than 90% of investments in the special economic zones are coming from foreign countries. That is a fact. Like the investments in Koha, in Dube Trade Port, in the East London IDZ, in Atlantis, all those investments come from foreign countries. And they are all happening on state-owned land. The entirety of special economic zones is state-owned land. What is of importance, of cardinal importance, is the security of tenure that is guaranteed to those investors in terms of saying that once you have been allocated this piece of land to establish your factory or whatever businesses that you want to establish, you are guaranteed security of tenure, and there won't be anyone who will come and disrupt your activities in the process of conducting your businesses. So that is the context within which this should have been located, so that we do not unnecessarily get shocked. There is no need to be shocked. There is nothing shocking, really, here. The laws of South Africa are clear in terms of what should happen. We just need to be resolute ourselves and perform the tasks that we have to perform. And from time to time, we then have to inform the investment community that now this is legislation. It happens in many instances. Even in the most advanced so-called democratic countries, the US, the European Union, when they change legislation, when they change regulations in terms of investment, they go to the investment community and say that it used to be like this, now it is like this. You then must find a way of how do you fit in with your investments. And if you think that you cannot fit in with your investments, you then pull out of that activity. So that is basically the whole issue. There is really no crisis. The Constitution adequately provides for us to perform the tasks that we have been mandated by the National Assembly to perform.
Not everybody was here in 2015. Not everybody participated in those processes, so members should reserve the right to be shocked and to feel that there is a crisis. And actually, we have not said that this engagement is the first and the last. We may call you in, and I think you correctly said this is not necessarily a legal opinion, and therefore
we may require a legal opinion. So allow members to be shocked, and then if necessary, to feel there's a crisis, and let them reserve that right. Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. I'd firstly like to inquire when DTI says that the introduction of their presentation, that their brief was to deal with South Africa's international obligations, whether, and I understand that they only deal with one part of our international obligations, the rest rests with Durco, whether these bilateral investment treaties are in fact the only international obligations under their jurisdiction which may impact on this whole process. So one, for example, also think of international trade agreements, and I would think it would be important for this committee to get also feedback as to what the situation is and the status will be of international trade agreements if and when the an amendment is made to Section 25. And then furthermore, it would be good to also get information from DTI in respect of the established principle that international agreements must, and others have alluded to that, on the one hand be consistent with our constitution, but then secondly with international law. And while one fully understands that in terms of international law, the way property rights are dealt with is deemed to be a matter that's falling within the sovereign authority of every country, there might still be rules in the international law which deals with specifically changes in the status of property rights and the impact that have on international obligations other than direct investment treaties. Thank you.
Over to you, but let me assure members that we will catch up with the situation as we pursue the program as prescribed by Parliament. So nothing is going to interfere with our time frames. But where we have to catch up, we'll catch up as the train moves. Honorable Matlhatsi, maybe you should come in
before the response. Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I see on page 5 of the presentation where we speak about the survival clause. I just want to understand what happens to a survival clause if the bilateral trade investment agreement expires after its agreed period of agreement. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I think we welcome very much the points made and the questions raised by honourable members. I think I was very deliberate in the beginning to say that this is not a legal opinion. This is based on... that this is not a legal opinion. This is based on the assessments that we've made through the review process and the concerns that were raised about the investment treaties in the review informed the decision by Cabinet in 2010 to terminate and to do the investment treaty and to look at a new approach to investment treaties in future. So I think what maybe the main point to make is that perhaps I know there have been a number of legal opinions that have been presented and prepared for the work of this committee. A legal opinion on these questions on the international dimensions should be, I imagine, would need to also supplement that work. It would need to look at the question that was raised, the first point of the relationship between the South African Constitution and international treaties. What is the relationship? We are part of the international community. We subscribe to the Vienna Convention that sets out some of these relationships. It would be important to take that into account. And some of the specific questions that arise in respect of investment treaties and the specific obligations set out in investment treaties on expropriation and compensation should be the subject of a full legal opinion. I should say that we were asked, I think, just a week or two ago to come to make this presentation. So it's in that context that a proper legal opinion would not have been possible. But I think this is a very important area, contribution to the debate, if we had that legal opinion. On the question of trade agreements, it's not clear. I mean, I think offhand I would say that the trade agreements, at least the ones that we have, South Africa has signed, don't have provisions that speak directly to questions of expropriation or compensation. The agreements, the international trade agreements that we have, are largely framed around tariff and tariff liberalization, rules about how we deal with customs, with standards of in international trade. They deal with trade in goods in particular. They don't deal in the same way that investment deals with, because there is property involved as such. It's about cross-border trade and the rules around that. So I would have to think again very carefully, but I see if I'm missing anything, but I can't imagine that the investment treaties have binding obligations. The trade agreements have binding obligations in this respect. More broadly, again, I think the questions of international law and property, perhaps that's also something that the legal opinion could deal with, and that was the other question that was raised. Again, I think our international DIRCO and the legal analysis could be done for that way. I think that's quite important that we also understand that relationship in particular. On the question of the survival clause, simply just to try to clarify if I was not clear, is if the agreement, for instance, was signed in 1995, for instance, and the period of validity is 10 years, so say 2005, it should be it reaches its first termination period. The way that the treaties were drafted said that unless you indicate you want to terminate, it's automatically renewed for another 10 years. So you have to, before the first period of validity is complete, you need to notify to say terminate, or say 1 year, usually 1 year before. So in the year 9, you have to tell them in year 10, it's not going to roll over, we want to end it. If you do that, and when the first period of validity is now over, you've formally notified that you want to terminate, then the survival clause kicks in. And then the survival clause will say, and again it's different for different agreements, will say the agreement is terminated, but the investments that were made during that period, of the first validity period, will continue to be protected under this agreement for another 10 years, 15 years, or 20 years, depending on the agreement. So it draws it out. It's not it doesn't end on that day. It is extended. That's how the agreements were signed. And of course, having looked at all of the agreements and the concerns that have been raised, as have been reflected here, was a motivation to terminate those agreements. But we still are in this. But I think, Chair, this is, as you say, this is perhaps the first engagement. I think it's important to have this out in the open, that these are discussed, and that perhaps the next step would be, as you say, a proper legal opinion. Thank you, Chair.
We are mindful of the fact that This was, we gave you short notice, and in terms of the brief given to you, you have done exceptionally well. And the nature of this process is that there will be continuous engagement, and I read that you would be open to such an engagement. So you have discharged yourself very well. Any other questions? Let me say that if members don't have any other questions, go and engage with the document. And in our next meetings, as we engage with the bill, the committee reserves the right to request further input. So we are going to have a continuous engagement, but I think that you have laid a very sound foundation for us to move forward. And we are actually grateful. And we're also mindful of the fact that the request was not directed to you personally. And it may be that it was short notice to the department and even a short, much more shorter notice to yourselves. So you have nothing to apologize for. But you have done very, very well. Honorable members, I want to assume that in the absence of further questions, we'll release the Honorable Ambassador and the meeting is adjourned.